Welcome to Dr. Barbara Bend, who is going to talk for us today. Dr. Bend read French at Cambridge and later did an MPhil and a PhD in Islamic art and archaeology at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. She has lectured for the British Museum and the British Library. As an independent scholar, her principal research is into form and meaning in Persian and Mughal manuscript illustration. Her books include, in 1991, Islamic Art, in 1995, The Emperor Akbar's Khamseh Nizami, Perspectives on Persian Painting, Illustrations to Amir Khosrow's Khamseh in 2003. In 2010, Muhammad Juki's Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, and with Professor Charles Melville, The Epic of Persian Kings in 2010, which was a catalog of an exhibition at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. The present volume was published last year, Treasures of Herat, two Timurid Khamseh of Nizami manuscripts. And without taking up any further time, I'm going to hand over to Barbara. Barbara, the metaphorical floor is yours.
Thank you. Right, thank you. Well, I'm sure I don't need to tell anybody from BIPS that the Khamseh of Nizami was written in the late 12th century. It is a quintet of five books. And we're very lucky to have two very celebrated ones in the British Library. These were largely illustrated in the 1490s in Herat, which was then under Hossein Baykara, the Timurid. There have been lots of ways of looking at these manuscripts because they're rather famous. I'm confronting them, but just particularly for today, I want to talk about the hands of different artists and whether one can distinguish them. In some ways, this is a rather old-fashioned approach, but I feel that we owe it to the artist to try and know who they are. And even if we don't always quite distinguish, I think it's a useful way of scrutinizing the pictures. Right, so this is one of the manuscripts, additional 25900. It has a very fine double illuminated page at the beginning in Herat style. Now, this would have been done in the 1440s. The manuscript has one colophon, but the colophon is in the first book of the five, so it could have been done later after that. Here's a detail of the artwork. Here is the colophon, which gives us 8, 4, 6, 1442, but likely work went on into 1443. Then here again is another view. Ah, bother. That's too much, too soon. There we go. There you can see the end of the colophon and on the bottom end of that. And you can see a bit of a line set on a diagonal, chalipar, as it said. And it has illumination above and below in triangles, but you can see that that's not the same quality of illumination as we have in the big page beside. So that's a different period. So I just wanted to put that in to show there's lots of different periods. It doesn't all get finished. It doesn't get finished in the 1440s. It doesn't even get finished in the 1490s. The bird is perhaps, the golden bird is perhaps of the 16th century, but not terribly easy to date. Now, the manuscript starts with a double frontispiece like this. And we have on the right, a prince and a princess entertained at night with music and song and wine. And on the left, we have a scene of cooking in a courtyard. Now, it's pretty much clear that these were not meant to be together at the first. For one thing, you can see that the rulings round them are different. The left hand has a heavy blue on the inner side, and the right hand has a moderate blue on the outer side. Furthermore, the right hand is at night. The left hand is probably during the day as the sky is golden. So the these have been brought together at some stage when somebody was improving the manuscript for sale or for whatever reason. In addition, the right-hand side has a funny sort of golden triangle-y bit up the top, right-hand top, and that is where there would have been lines of text which have been blanked out. So it isn't difficult, in fact, to replace this picture into the manuscript and to see that it is, in fact, Khosrow and Shireen entertained in a garden. Now, if you look at the detail, you can see what I feel is the particular character of this painter. The figures are elegant, very slim, narrow-shouldered, long fingers, and they have a sort of an air of tension or fragility about them, I think. So I have looked through and seen where I think that painter is at work. Here we are again, the same painter, I believe. Here we have Khosrow and Shireen. They've come together, but then they've had a bit of a quarrel and they're apart, and Khosrow has, on the pretext of hunting, gone running about the country and come to the castle where Shireen is holed up. This picture has in the upper bit of work at the top of the architecture, the date, which I put on the left. And that gives you 895, which gives you 1490. So that is the date of this picture and of the pictures that more or less resemble that. One rather assumes that when the picture contains the date, that means it's the sort of top painter, at least for the moment, in that group. And I think probably this is the work of Shah Muzaffar. He was learning painting at the same time as the famous painter Behzad was, but he dies rather early in his 24th year. His father, Mansur, had been the top man of the workshop, the Ketabkhane. So he's a man of status, but I may be overinterpreting, but I see these rather fragile figures as possibly in parallel with whatever it was that carried him off in his 24th year. Anyway, there we have our Khosrow below, and we'll see him again. But first of all, this is a curious thing. The scene at the window in which Shireen receives him, I find it a bit difficult to be sure which of these three ladies is actually Shireen. We have the one in green who is lovelorn. We have the one in blue who is, I think, about to throw down either the scent or the whole scent bottle. And then we have one behind who is evidently more of a servant who's restraining her. But I did just wonder if they were, in a sense, indicating different facets of what Shireen is feeling at one time. But again, that may be a bit over the top. Now, here again, I think the same painter, which I take to be Shah Muzaffar. Here we have Majnun. As a boy, Qais had been at school with Layla, fallen in love with her. You know this all probably better than I do. He goes mad for love, is known as Majnun, wanders about. His father takes him to the Kaaba in the hope that this will cure him of his madness. Majnun takes hold of the ring of the Kaaba and declares that he is a ring-wearing slave of love and that he wants it to continue. So again, tall figures, long fingers, narrow shoulders. An interesting variety of faces, but the one who is left-hand corner but one in, the man with the bare head, he's been overpainted in India. So we see touches of Indian work just from here and there occasionally. Now, this, I think, is not Shah Muzaffar. This, it has a note saying that it's the work of Behzad, which is between the two middle panels below the picture. And I think it must be. This is Bahram Gur, the great hunter. In his youth, he's been pursuing the onager, the wild ass, and one female onager has sort of led him on and brought him to the lair of a dragon. So he thinks that the dragon's a better quarry than an onager. So he goes for the dragon, kills it, cuts it open, and finds inside the undamaged foal of the onager. So he knows what she meant, what she was on about. This is a wonderfully vigorous figure. To me, he has much more energy than the figures in the previous style. He's got perhaps, there's perhaps a touch of humor in the fact that one flap of his cap has nearly come down over his face as he makes this bold attempt. His horse also seems to be up for it. I think, so far as I understand Behzad, I think he has a keen sense of animals as sentient creatures. So that horse looks keen, just like his rider. And Mrs. Onager has an air of sort of nervousness, but expectation. She's hoping for the best from this. The dragon is a wonderful creature. It's obviously slightly colored to match its habitat, but you see where it is by the red flash of its mouth. It's coming, sneaking out of its cave. One feels that the tree that it's sort of supporting itself on is in a way a map of the amount of dragon that there might still be behind in the cave. So I take that for Behzad. So here we have that keen, eager, vigorous little boy. And on the right, we have the Hosrow from the previous picture, which I think is by Shah Muzaffar. I think these are different painters. I know that obviously the subject is different, and that of course would affect somehow whether the action was vigorous or not, but I see these as different. This again, I take to be Behzad. This is Mahan, a merchant who's gone about a rather greedy search for wealth. And he's trying to return and he gets caught by sort of various misleading people who get him into a desert. And he thinks he's just riding home when suddenly he comes upon a group of demons who block his way. Not only do demons block his way, but at that moment, his horse develops seven dragon heads. I just wonder if there's a slight joke in the colouring of the dragon's head, if the painter, if Behzad, was perhaps thinking of the colours associated with the pavilions that Bahram Gur visits. Anyway, it's a fascinating figure. Obviously, the colour catches one at first, but then it's quite powerful. I find that the hand that supports him on the rump of his mount gives a sense of physicality. And then there's a good joke in that it's literally got a sting in the tail, this creature. So there he is clinging on and his toes are spread as he tries to hold on. And then this is the sort of demon that those demons are modeled on, but this is one of the original pictures which perhaps are of the 14th century and are one of the great puzzle questions about how they came into Islamic art, etc. But you can see that the demons we have down the left-hand side of the picture have modified considerably from that, though they've still got the proper costume and the tokens. And they are lashing away with torches of flame, but something which goes beyond what the text tells us, they are also, two of them, encumbered by their young, which is really quite a good joke, I think. And then up at the top of the column, you see what appears to be a sort of henpecked husband demon who's being forced to give a piggyback to what I take to be his wife or lady friend. Again, you can see the idea of physicality in the stabilizing hand on her ankle and the fact that she's got a strong hold on one of his horns as though it was handlebars almost. And then up above, beyond the horizon, which I just recently sort of thought about, there are three demons in conversation, and they seem to me for all the world like sort of sporting pundits commenting on the event. Now, let me get it. This is a picture from the Mahzan al-Asra, 20 small stories attached to homilies at the beginning in the first book. And here we have the old woman who approaches Shah Sanjar, Sultan Sanjar, and says that, will he please pay more attention to ruling the country decently, because all sorts of horrible things are happening to her and she's being maltreated by his officers and accused of this and that, and it's all ghastly, and will he please do something? So that's the basic story. He is painted in a way that from later pictures we recognize as showing the ruler of the time, Sultan Hussein, sort of broad face with a fairly heavy chin, beard, and this lightish green costume, which seems to be the appropriate thing for princes. And in fact, we do know that Sultan Hussein wore green. And then we have the, on the main picture, we have an umbrella attaching this scene below into a scene of what you might call ordinary life above. Possibly it's meant to say that the old lady's overdoing her complaint. Now, I think that the painter of left, which I take to be Bessard, had seen this picture, which is another manuscript of the British Library, the Epics Oriental 2780 of 1397. So I think he's been able to see this in the Royal Library. It's not the same topic. This is the Mongols coming out of the mountain. I think he's seen it and kind of meditated on it to produce a new idea. You've got quite a lot of action down in the foreground. You have the idea of tents seen behind the horizon. And in the middle ground, you have a mule coming out of a cave. And there's no reason why the Sultan Sanjar story should have a mule in it and a gentleman taking water out of a pool with a golden cup, unless you'd seen in the bottom right of this picture somebody doing just that. So I think it's a sort of a, I wouldn't say a meditation on this, but it's a derivation. It's a, what can I use from this older picture? And I think this ability to, well, in a way, think outside the box is based on. Then the manuscript has at the end some pictures which are later, probably from the maybe early 1520s, when Bessard had been transferred to Tabriz. And I think he was probably relaying his talents to a younger painter here. Here we have Iskander Alexander, who has come to consult a hermit about a problem he's having about how to destroy a castle full of robbers. So we've got a rather different sort of rock mode with rather dreamy sort of smooth rocks. We have a moon with scudding clouds over it. Unfortunately, it's been a bit trimmed at the edge. I think that if we compare that with this, this is a picture from the Shahnameh produced for Shah Tahmasp, which has the one dated picture of 1527 in it, which Stuart Carey Welsh attributes to Mirza Ali. I think that inclines me to believe that the picture on the right is an early work of Mirza Ali. You see again an interest in a moon. It may look a bit sunlight, but I think it's a moon, we're at night, and clouds. And I think if we'd had more of the clouds in the top right of right, we would have seen this sort of blurring edges. And another thing is that it has an interest in rather densely packed illumination as a pattern on the right hand in textile on the garment of Iskander. And on the left hand, it occurs in the little dome over the throne. Yeah, that's where it occurs. So anyway, my guess is that that one is Mirza Ali. So now we go to the other manuscript. This is the manuscript Oriental 6810, which again is very well known. And this has a singular frontispiece, which is clearly very intentional and meaningful, but exactly what the meaning is a bit disputed. We have a gentleman who's being shown a letter on the right, and he is obviously a man of considerable importance because he's got all this retinue on the left. And we have a note below the picture saying it is the work of Mirak Horasani, who at some point became the director of the Kitabhane, of the library workshop. So it's an important picture by an important man. Here we have the detail, and there's possibly even a suggestion of portraiture in the gentleman who's receiving the picture. There's a whole sort of argument about who it could be. There is an emir of Sultan Hussein, whose name is rather similar to the name that has partly been detected on this bit of writing. This bit of writing is extraordinarily difficult to read, and Ursula Sims Williams from the library has very kindly gone over it. I think that this is not an emir. I think this is a collateral of Sultan Hussein, who was just about this 1495 moment making a bid for Samarkand. And I think Sultan Hussein has asked for a diplomatic gift to persuade this chap that he is a valued inferior, but an inferior. Anyway, there's a whole long spiel that can be unwound in that. Those faces are rather square, and the same sort of squareness and a sort of slightly chunky physique is visible in this picture. to which someone has added an attribution of mirac at the bottom in rather undistinguished writing. This is Shireen receiving the picture of Hosro that Shapur has hung in a tree. So there she is. We've got lady very much at ease, some singers, attendants, everything you need, a rather straight up tree. Now, this picture has several dandelions in it. And the dandelion is actually not frequently, to my knowledge, displayed in Persian painting, but there is a dandelion in the, well, actually two, in the frontispiece we've just looked at. So I'm prepared to see the dandelion as a sort of a token of the work of Mirac Horasani. I think at some point during the making of this manuscript, he passes away from the scene, whether he actually dies, is retired or what, but I think he's in control at the beginning of the manuscript, but I think the control then passes to Behzad. This is the Sultan Sanjar scene. So from the first book in Oriental 6810, and here you can see the contrast. This is Mirac on the right and presumed Behzad on the left. And you can see what a change must have taken place. Mirac is doing a much plainer style, stiffer. If the Behzad had already been painted, which it could well have been, he must have thought, what a very, you know, fussy modern contraption that is. Why don't we go for the plain old fashioned style? He's not yet, as you see, using the umbrella to sort of hitch into anything. This is a picture which has readily and often been seen as the work of Behzad, and I see no reason to quarrel with that. You have the connecting line running through it. You have the significant colors holding it together and taking you piece by piece from blue place to blue place. You have a touch of humor in the rather careful modesty of people changing. And you have over on the right, an enigmatic gentleman who's a sort of watcher, scrutinizer of the scene. I should have said it's Hussein, Harun al-Rashid in the barbers, and the barber is so bold as to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage, which is not what you usually ask the caliph. And it is diagnosed that he's able to do that because he is standing over where there is buried treasure. So it's one of these little strange moral parables. Here again, I think we're absolutely confidently within the style of Behzad. It's the building of Havanak, the palace built for Bahram Gur. It's a wonderful picture in which it's hard to keep one's eye still. You reproduce the movement of the action as you pop from color to color, and the lines which take you up and which take you moving, the sense of physicality. The wonderful effect from Mr. Red, who is throwing a brick up to Mr. Blue, and you can see how that's going to connect into his waiting hands. And then lovely things like the mortar in the bottom left, which is just the right color, but it doesn't have a precise edge so that you know that it's a sort of mushy substance. I have speculated that the reason we have, that perhaps something in the scaffolding coupled with the fact that we have a gentleman who is facing outwards while going up a ladder, which is a strange thing to do, I think there may be some influence from a Western picture of a crucifixion. Obviously, I've got no particular client for this, but I put in an example. Here again, I think we're Bessard. This is mourning for the death of Layla's husband, where I think probably the lady who is in the most state of collapse would be the mother of the husband rather than Layla herself, who only finds it a good occasion to cry. Then I think this is Bessard, and I think he is following a work that he himself had done originally in the Hamze of Amir Hosro, produced in 1485. I think we can see it's got the same architectural structure, the same key moment behind the wall, the same person coming out to attend to people beyond. And I think even the poplar tree. Can I take this out? This little thing that go off if something dreadful happens. No. I think even the sort of swaying poplar tree has, he's reminded himself of it, and he's given that shape to the man who is mourning or possibly calling an azan from the roof. This, I think, is one of the greatest pictures. One could say perhaps the greatest picture by Bessard. It is Farhad, who has just received false news of the death of Shireen from this wicked man in the brown, and he's thrown himself off the rocks and died. The painter has interestingly inserted a couple of deer in the bottom left corner, who are more usually to be associated with Majnun, but they've come in here as spectators. I think the wonderful thing about this picture is the colouring of the background, so that we're in shade, where in sadness the sunny world has departed. There are two marvellous faces here. This is the face of Farhad, which has passed from franticness, killing himself by falling off the cliff, into tranquility. He is, as it were, in some sort of paradise to which his love for Shireen has carried him. And then the face of the other, who has this sort of spectator role, who is racked with guilt at what he's done, but almost I feel that the guilt doesn't stay with him. It slightly comes out and accuses the viewer in a sense of, what would you have done? What do you feel about it? Don't you have something to regret as well? Now, here we have, oh, bother, too much. Come back. Yes. Here we have on the right a picture of Bahram Gur fighting the dragon, and on the left, the one you've seen before from the other manuscript. I don't think these can possibly be by the same painter. And indeed, there is a note on the right-hand one saying it's the work of Qasim Ali, who is a student of Bessard. I think you can see how he's trying to be the student of Bessard. He's following the main composition, and he's put his rider in that red-orange color, which is what Mahan was wearing when attacked by demons. He's had a couple of ideas which aren't so clever, I think. He's thinned out the rock to make the dragon's head show better, but it actually doesn't look quite so fierce. And when you see it close to, it's actually rather furry. And he has put in, he perhaps doesn't quite know the story, he's put in Fetne, the harpist, who accompanies Bahram Gur later in his life, in place of the mother Onager. So he's trying, but he hasn't quite sort of got everything, he hasn't got all his ducks in a row. And also, I feel one doesn't have the sort of delightful resolve of the young man in green. This one is posed nicely on his horse, but you don't feel that he's so eager to attack. We have here a sort of golden yellow ground with little bluish rocks on it. And in the rock, we have a tinge of a sort of turquoise color, which I think gets to be a favorite of Qasim Ali. Because here we have it again. Here, I think we have Qasim Ali. Here we have Bishr, who's been traveling. He has found a companion, Malika. Malika has insisted on taking a bathe in a pool, but has drowned himself. And Bishr is here trying to fish him out. So Malika is somebody who's got things wrong. Bishr is a virtuous man who's got things right. We have got action here, but it's rather frozen in one pose, I think. We have a tree which is swaying gently over. We have the rock which has the flashes of turquoise green in it, and we have the golden tawny ground. I think these match through. Here again, we have an attribution to Qasim Ali. This is Layla and Qais at school. And again, one feels that the whole composition hinges on one kneeling figure, to wit, Layla in the reddish orange color at the top. We've got school children who are doing things, but they're in a sort of ideal pose. You don't get the feeling of everybody running about and moving that you get in Bethard's picture of the workman. We have again an elegantly posed tree, a chinar. Right, now here we go. And here again, I think Qasim Ali, we have the death of Majnun on Layla's grave. So I think he's picked up from Behzad the idea of the sad part of the picture with a sort of bluish background and a more sunny background for ordinary life continuing beyond. But he has here very wisely made the water a key point of the death area, because it is surrounded by blossoms, and this is telling us that the love of Layla and Majnun is something greater than ordinary life. We have in this picture the curious picture of somebody with perhaps a shepherd's pipe, brought very much to our attention because he's sitting on an extra knob of rock, which in a sense didn't need to be there, but he's facing away from us. But above his head is an attribution to Qasim Ali, which, as Ursula Sims has kindly pointed out, is spelt in a rather odd way with an extra vav in it. So anyway, I'd just like you to bear in mind the oddity of this and whether there's an association between the man whose face is not shown and the man who perhaps was the painter of the picture. Because here is another picture which has a slightly rubbed out attribution in the text panel to Qasim Ali. This is the young man who owns a garden. He wants to visit it one day, but as he enters, he's captured by a couple of female guards and frog marched off to a window from which he is able to see ladies bathing. So we have the ladies bathing. Again, they're elegantly posed, but not quite in movement, perhaps, or maybe I'm overstating this. The lady who's about in green, who's about to be pushed into the water by someone in blue, it's paused. You can't sort of see a follow through in the action there. Now, the owner of the garden is therefore in that little window up there, and you see his eye as he peers out, and you see his fingers even as they curl around the edge of the shutter. But what I found was very interesting was that above his turban, in the area just above his turban, there's something else. There's the name of Qasim Ali. And I think it would be implausible that anyone other than the painter could have stuffed it in there. So I think that this is Qasim Ali saying, I'm the man who isn't being seen. I think he's perhaps slightly contesting with his master Behzad for more visibility. Here we have the visit of Iskander to the sage as rendered in Oriental 6810. We've seen it before in the Safavid version in additional 25900. So here is Iskander. Here is one of the most beautiful rockscapes in Persian painting, with on some of the rocks that slight glint of the bright turquoisey green, and Iskander, and the tree that sways in a sort of elegant framing manner that we have seen in the work of Qasim Ali. Here is our Iskander, elegantly drawn and evidently intended to portray Hossein Baykara. I'm not bothering to show you the picture, which is not from the manuscripts, but a single picture of him, which makes it quite clear that that's who it is. He's in the green, he's in this characteristic kneeling pose. But then we also have a picture, which I do take to be by Behzad. This picture has the date in it, again, out of the architecture. And this gives us 900 or 1495. So possibly 5 years later than the illustrations and the previous book, if they all got in more or less the same time. 1490 is the other book. 1495, this book. But I think this shows control. I think it shows that Behzad is in control of the manuscript, and I think it's also meant to show that Hossein Baykara is in charge of the political situation, which is what I think the picture's about. So here he is, kneeling again. And if you just describe it in brief words, it's just like the picture we've just previously, the rendering of Hossein Sultan Hussein in the previous picture. But if you put them together, I think they're not possibly by the same painter, especially if the left-hand one, I'll leave that bit. So same costume, same posture, same even way of doing little white dots on the turban, the fan end of the turban. But the one on the left is a sort of classically posed, elegant, possibly one would say a little younger. The one on the right, which I take to be Behzad, you feel a solidity, a certain weight in the figure, though it's nearly all done with outline. There are some fold lines, but the way the waistline slightly bulges towards the crook of the elbow, the head's held a little lower. I think that the man on the painter on the left has just been very well taught by the painter on the right. Thank you. That's what I wanted to say. Inch.
Barbara, thank you very, very much. That's absolutely delightful. I'm interested in the student-teacher relationship. Could you comment a little bit on how that actually practically worked? And how many other examples do we have there?
We don't have much detail on how it was done. We know father to son that Shah Muzaffar was the son of Mansur. So presumably daddy taught him. Behzad is possibly an orphan. Some people say he's an orphan. So he doesn't get his training from his papa, probably. But he and Shah Muzaffar both work for Ali Shir Navai. And then we get Behzad mentioned as being, on the one hand, a pupil of Mirak, and on the other, the master of Qasim Ali and somebody else whose name escapes me at this moment. So we don't know how it's done, which was why I was trying to look at how much it might be from studying previous or other work. And I think Behzad gets quite into studying some European pictures if he can get his hands on them. One sees an advance in shading and things, but exactly how it worked and how much paper was used for rough work is a fascinating question, but we haven't got the answers.
Barbara, I want to thank you so much. It was absolutely splendid last webinar for our 2022-2023 webinar series.
Thank you.
Enjoyed that. Have a pleasant morning, afternoon, or evening. Thank you very much, and bye-bye from us.